May it please the board, as I stated, my name is Will Stephen, I represent the appellants in this case, which is Bill Winland, 120 MP, and Loren Towers. Basically, my client owns, Bill Winland owns two buildings in Victoria, and they are in separate entities, but he is the sole owner of both of them, so I'll collectively refer to him as Mr. Winland for the purpose of the argument. This is actually a fairly simple case. Mr. Winland needed insurance for his buildings, and so he was getting insurance through Stevens Insurance. And you'll also hear the name Amwins, which is another, he's an insurance agent or broker. Amwins is another insurance agent or broker. Those terms are used interchangeably a lot. And then there's Lloyd's Underwriters, or certain underwriters of Lloyd's, which is basically an insurance syndicate in London, a lot of times referred to as Lloyd's of London. But when you see all those other names in there, those are different people that are part of Lloyd's of London that were underwriting this particular policy. So anyway, he purchased the insurance. The policy is in effect from March 8th, 2017 to March 8th, 2018. As I'm sure y'all are aware, we had a hurricane during that time that actually sat over Victoria for a while and was, you know, created a lot of damage. We had other hurricanes in Victoria, and some people got damaged, but in this hurricane, really everybody got damaged.
Council, before you go further, let's talk about before he got the insurance. They're contending that your client got a quote, and that the quote specifically excluded named storm, I guess, that being, you know, any storms that they've given a name to.
Okay. So as far as the named storm exclusion, is there contention? Mm-hmm. So this is a written contract, and there's lots of bargaining, negotiating goes on before a written contract. Mm-hmm. Mr. Winland says, I wanted coverage for a hurricane, and my, you know, Stevens knew about it. Everyone knew I wanted coverage for a hurricane. They say, well, we put this deal, it says named storm exclusion, but the language of the exclusion is not included and was never provided to Mr. Winland until after the hurricane. So when we have this kind of he said, she said stuff, mm-hmm. and we have a fully executed contract, we don't look at the parole evidence. We don't look at what he said, what, you know, because if this, let's just flip it around. Let's say that Mr. Winland said, well, I really wanted hurricane coverage. And they had included a named storm exclusion in the policy. Well then, just because Mr. Winland wanted hurricane coverage for a hurricane doesn't mean that he would have coverage for a hurricane if it was excluded in the policy.
So the quote that they're alluding to was not in writing?
It was in writing, but it was, and there's two things. There's one that was for a previous policy. Mm-hmm. There's something else that was provided kind of on the day of the policy, and it says named storm exclusion. Again, the term of the named storm exclusion is not included. Also, in the quotes, in everything that went on in this case, other than the policy, they all say this is not the policy. You have to look at the policy to know what the policy says. Also, in the policy, it says you can't look at anything else other than the policy.
Yeah, I didn't know exactly where in the policy it says that. I know I read it, and then I tried to go back and find it.
Yes, it is on, actually have it, I was going to go through it, but it's on page 554 of the record. The policy itself, I mean, there's, so what you have is you have a bunch of forms that are included in the policy, but it's on page 28 of SRU 003, but 554 of the record where it says, and I'll just, This policy contains all of the agreements between you and us concerning the insurance afforded. And that's an important provision because it means that my client can't go back and say, well, this is not what I meant for the policy to be. Likewise, Lloyd's of London can't go back and say, well, this is not what I meant for the policy to say. When we have a fully integrated policy that says that you don't look at anything else, then you don't go to other sources to figure out what the policy means. You have to look at it based on the four corners of the policy itself.
Mr. Skiba, though, in this case, I mean, isn't it your, I thought your client was saying, well, yes, I looked at the policy, and we don't look at other stuff because I never got the exclusion, correct?
Yes, it is undisputed that he never received the named storm exclusion until after the storm. It was never delivered to him.
What of their agency arguments? How do you dispute that?
So I think that whenever you first look at this, and that's a good question, and so I think when you look at this, if you look at the policy itself, so first off, the first issue is whether or not the original policy contained the exclusion act. When you look at the policy itself, there is a list of forms, and this is on page 418 of the record, that lists all the forms that are included in the policy. And there's a mold exclusion. There's a war terrorism exclusion. There's an earth moving exclusion. There's all these exclusions that are listed, but one exclusion that is absent is the named storm exclusion. And so this policy was signed by someone with Amwins Special Risk Underwriters, LLC. They're referred to as the cover holder. And according to the policy, they have the authority to bind Lloyd's to this policy. And you'll see that authority on page 420 of the record. It says that, and in consideration of the premiums specified herein, underwriters hereby binds themselves to this policy. So this is the policy that they bound themselves to. If you look further down on page 420, it says the certificate will not be valid unless signed by the correspondent. On the attached declaration page, you look at the declaration page, that's where it's two pages. One has the forms applicable that doesn't include named storm exclusion, and one has how much they're paying for the policy, or what the cost of the policy is.
But also that policy, I'm sure, says that they can issue endorsements later on. I guess my question is this, what would your position be today if he had received the endorsement with it?
That's good. I think, and if you look at our case, and this is a Supreme Court case, is
was it the Vela v. Catwood?
No, it's Travelers Indemnity versus Edwards. Mm-hmm. And this is a case, so the agency deals with modification. So if you take, as is true, and as is shown in the original policy, that the original policy does not have a named storm exclusion, then you have to move to modification. Was the policy modified to include the named storm exclusion? In order to have a modification, you have to fulfill all the elements of a contract. You have to have an offer, you have to have an acceptance, meeting the minds, delivery, and then you also have to have consideration. And so the deal with Travelers, we look at the Travelers case, which is a 1970 Supreme Court case, but it has no red flags on it, it's never been disagreed with, never been overturned, so it's still binding authority. What it says, this is a case where a student at a student college bought an insurance policy, and they forgot to put basically something on there that said, well, only the student can drive this vehicle. They sent that change to the student, and he signed it and sent it back. And the Supreme Court held that even though the student received the change, he signed the change, he sent the state change back, it was not effective because there was no consideration for the change. And so, in this case, if it had just been delivered to Mr. Winland, then I don't think, based on that Supreme Court case's logic, that would be an effective change. I think they would have had to say, hey, not that it couldn't be changed. Number one, there's deals where they can cancel the policies. They could have said, well, hey, we left this off,
Let's start anew.
Let's start anew. Let's change the policy. Let's make sure that Mr. Winland understands and signs off on this and consents to this change. And then the policy could have been correctly changed. One thing they could have said is that if you don't agree to this change, then we're not going to continue to insure you. And that, according to the Supreme Court, in the case I was mentioning earlier, and in the Travelers Indemnity Company, and that is at 462 Southwest 2nd, 533. You know, if they said, well, hey, we're going to change this policy or we're not going to insure you anymore, and he said, okay, well, I still want to be insured with you, so I'm going to agree to the change. But you have to have all the elements of a contract in order to modify a contract. And so even if they had just sent it by email to Mr. Winland, that still wouldn't have been enough to change the policy without an offer, an acceptance, and consideration and delivery. So the next question that you were asking, and I'm sorry for not addressing that directly, is, well, what about the agency argument? Was Stevens Insurance Mr. Winland's agent in this case? And I think that when you look at the cases, it really doesn't matter if he was or wasn't his agent because there was not a valid modification. But on the other hand, one thing, and the defendants and the appellees in this case have constantly tried to shift the case on to the appellants in the case. You know, this was a summary judgment case. They have the burden to conclusively establish everything. And so they have to conclusively, there's no doubt that there's a contract. They have to conclusively establish that the name storm exclusion was included in the contract at the beginning, which the straightforward evidence is that it was not. They have to conclusively establish that there was a valid modification. And then as a part of that modification, which really only relates to the delivery portion, they have to conclusively establish that Stevens Insurance was their agent. And so general contract law, and you know, there's a Corpus Christi court case, I believe it's Hunt versus State. And this 1987 case, it says agents can act as both, as an agent for both the insurer and the insurer or and the insured. An insurance agent acts for the insured in making the application for insurance and processing the policy. So making the application and processing the policy, he's acting for the insured. He acts as the agent for the insurer, the insurance company, in delivering the policy and collecting the premiums. And so just based on the general law, he's not our agent. And that's also, you saw some other cases that stand for the same law. And then going further, they have produced no evidence that Mr. Winland ever gave Stevens Insurance the authority to act as this agent for receiving the policy. And there's just no evidence one way or the other. So they have not met their burden in showing that he was Mr. Winland's agent.
Well, when the policy was delivered, did the policy go through the agent, the original policy, the one that you did exist, or was it mailed directly to your client, or did your client go to Stevens or the agent and sign the policy there?
The policy was sent to the agent and then delivered to my client. And it's our position that Amwins and Lloyd's of London was relying on them to, he was their agent for delivering the policy to us, because that is something that's required. The policy has to be delivered to the insured. And so Stevens was their agent to fulfill that part of their obligation under the contract. I'm down to 38 seconds. Are there any other questions that y'all have for me? If not, then I'll go ahead and address y'all again after opposing counsel.
Thank you. Ms. Alcaz.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. This is a very simple case at its heart. We were this case fire from
remorse. The plaintiffs wanted property insurance for their buildings in Victoria. They wanted to get the most affordable policy possible, and the premiums are lower when you don't have hurricane coverage. And that's what they purchased, that's what they wanted, but then lo and behold, that year there's a hurricane, and now they're trying to use this one little error in the timing of the delivery of the endorsement to try and say, KingsX, you were not allowed to correct this policy, and you owe us now for hurricane damage, which is not anything that my clients ever agreed to do. And that's what I want to point out. And it's very clear, you know, now the plaintiffs are trying to say, well, we didn't know and we wanted the hurricane coverage all along, but it's very clear that that was not the case. Because the documentary evidence shows that in the application, they requested a named storm exclusion along with other exclusions, and they received a binder, before that they received a quote that had on it also a named storm exclusion. Their agent, Stevens, replied saying, go on and bind the quote. So then they issued the binder. The binder said, and Mr. Winlet testified to this at his deposition, that if he had read the binder, it said in no fewer than four places on one page, named storm excluded. Then they issued the policy, and to answer Justice Hinojosa's question, yes, they issued the policy from the cover holder, through their broker, Amwins Brokerage of Alabama, to the plaintiff's broker or agent, which was Stevens, who then delivered that to the plaintiffs. And shortly after issuance of the policy, discovered that the endorsement was missing from the policy that they sent, and then forwarded through that chain again, the endorsement, along with four other endorsements, which are not at issue here.
But, Counselor, don't you think that from the appellant's point of view, he had a policy, a hurricane occurs, he looks at his policy, and the policy he has in front of him says has no exclusion. Aren't you entitled to rely on that contract?
Well, no, because his agent, through his agent, he requested a policy that would not have that. And he might not have ever even got a policy. We can enter into contracts that are never even delivered to us, and that doesn't mean that they're not binding. You know, that's another thing with agency. Like, they're trying to conflate what the duties of the agent are by using examples of retail agents who may be exclusively for State Farm or Farmers or something. And you might go to your neighborhood farmer's agent, and they may act as agent for both you and for the insurer. Here, we have alien insurers. They're called alien because they're foreign, and which is like a surplus lines insurer. They are not admitted to do business in Texas, so they go through agents who are. And so they go through Amwins Brokerage of Alabama, who's admitted as their agent. And then when the plaintiffs are shopping their policy, they're going through their agent, which is Stevens and Mr. Messeroli.
But isn't Stevens an agent for both?
No.
And so in delivering, when a commission's paid, don't you pay the commission to the broker?
We pay a commission to our broker, who then may share that commission with the retail agent.
And in this case, that was a situation, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Is there actually a licensing agreement between the Stevens entity and the Lloyd's entities? Somewhere there's got to be.
No.
So
there is not.
Anybody can write a Lloyd's policy.
Only through the ones that we are contracted with, which is the cover holder, can write the policy. And that is Amwins Specialty Risk Underwriters, an entity that's not in this case.
But all these people are your agents?
No.
And how is that?
Because we go through the ones that are our agents. So the cover holder goes through Amwins Brokerage of Alabama. And we agree that they are acting as our agent,
okay,
my client's agent. But now what they do with other retail agencies or brokers, that's up to them. That they are not acting as our agent. we never communicate directly with the plaintiffs. We only ever communicated with our agents, who only ever communicated with Stevens.
So is AIM, is that the name of that entity?
Amwins?
Yes, Amwins. Does it have an agent relationship with Stevens?
I don't know, and I don't believe so. I think that he tried to create one with the argument of an email where they said in the email when they were forwarding it, the endorsement, you know, please send this to your client, that created an instruction and created an agency agreement. That's one of their arguments in their brief. And that is a stretch. There's no evidence of that being anything other than, like, a favor, or we would hope that the retail agent would deliver the stuff to their client. But
didn't you have a responsibility? If you write the policy, don't you have a responsibility? I mean, especially where you were in error here. Somebody somewhere made a boo-boo. Wouldn't you think it'd be super important to have that change sent directly to that person that paid for this coverage and believes they have it?
We can't send the stuff directly to the person.
Okay.
We have to go through their agent.
Okay.
And that's one of their things that they were trying to argue, is like, well, you should have sent it to, we can't send it to you. This is the insurance code. We have to send it to your agent. And so we did.
And I also noticed that from the time you issued the endorsement and to the time you sent it to the agent, Stevens, it was like a month.
Yes, it was about a month. It was about, yes. It was
so what hypothetically, let's pretend like there's a hurricane in April before mm-hmm. you let the agent know about this endorsement that you've already put in place. Not only have you put it in place, but you say it was retroactive to the very beginning. The agent doesn't know. What would your position be with regard to coverage at that point?
Your Honor, that's a great question, and that would be a different situation. Then you would need to have probably a reformation of the contract to reflect the terms that were originally wanted by the parties. So this is not a modification, what occurred here. He's trying to argue that this is some sort of unilateral modification that required consideration. It's not. We didn't get extra consideration because it wasn't a modification. We were only doing what the parties agreed to do from the very beginning. If you have a situation where, let's say, the hurricane happened and the endorsement hadn't issued yet, then you should request reformation of the policy so that the contract accurately reflects what the party's intent was from the beginning.
Counsel, is there a totally different policy? Like, let's say that it had been done correctly. Would it have been done via an exclusion, or would it have been done via an endorsement? How would, like, would the policy have looked different if it had that named, you know, storm exclusion?
No, Your Honor, it would not have looked differently.
Okay, it would have had an endorsement.
It would just have had this endorsement.
The same exact endorsement that you sent later?
Correct.
Okay. And now, does the agreement that or the contract that the policyholder did receive, does that make reference to future endorsements, that you may be receiving future endorsements?
Yes.
It's contained.
And we cite that language in our reply brief, I believe, and it says that the company, being us, the underwriters, can issue endorsements later. And it just says us. It doesn't say the other side can issue endorsements to the contract, just my client's side. And in fact, Mr. Mesaroli testified at his deposition that that's not an unfrequent occurrence. That happens very often. And they have procedures in place to ensure that they get these things to their clients. And he agreed that in this situation, they cannot find any evidence that their procedures were followed and that it was delivered to their client. So they've got if what they say is true occurred, they have the correct parties in this suit. They've sued Stevens and Mesaroli. They've sued their agent. So it's not like they're without recourse if what they say happened occurred the way it happened.
Were they given a quote for both did they receive a quote initially that one for hurricane coverage and one for without hurricane coverage? Or they only received one quote?
In the original version of this policy, which was for the year before, the policy year that was 2016 to 2017, they did. And it showed that the premium was almost double to have that coverage on the policy. They elected to get, this is kind of confusing, but they elected to not get the named storm coverage the prior year, but the same mistake was made the prior year, only there wasn't a hurricane, so nobody caught it. Then the policy gets renewed. They still want to have the named storm exclusion because they know it's going to be roughly a lower premium. And this time they catch the error about 3.5 weeks later and issue the endorsement to fix the policy 4 months before the storm ever comes.
Counselor, so you don't believe that there are any fact issues here? You know, for example, that there are disputes regarding, you know, who was supposed to give the copy, you know, to the plaintiff, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, shouldn't we then remand the case to have a jury decide these fact issues?
Well, we take the position that there are no fact issues that are material to the claims. The only fact issue is Bill Winlett saying, well, I intended for this to be hurricane coverage. Well, we don't need to look at that parole evidence when we have a contract. And we know what the intent of the contract was and that endorsement was supposed to be on there and not as a modification because the application said they wanted a named storm exclusion. The quotation said this is with a named storm exclusion. The binder said in four places, this is with a named storm exclusion, and then we ultimately issue the policy with the endorsement 3.5 weeks later with a named storm exclusion. And they're trying to make every kind of argument to try and not make that stick, that that's not what they wanted, because now they're finding out, you know, they needed it. It was a penny wise and a pound foolish. To not get the named storm coverage.
So what entity, I'm sorry, there's so many of them, it's confusing,
yes.
Actually profits from issuing the policy?
So my clients do collect a premium for the policy. They share that premium as a commission with their agent, their cover holder and their agent. And the cover holder is not a party to this case. Their agent was Amwins Brokerage of Alabama. And then Amwins Brokerage of Alabama may share some of that commission with the retail agent. That's up to them. That goes down the chain. But they are not our agent. Stevens is not our agent.
Do you think that might even create a fact issue that Stevens is your agent because you share in profits?
No, I don't believe so, because agency comes from the principal. So the agency relationship can only be created by a principal. And we, the underwriters, never agreed for Stevens to be our agent. There is no agency relationship on the part of the principals. And they have no evidence that we did. In fact, we brought the Vela case up because that's the closest case we could find on point where somebody's trying to argue this. And they tried to distinguish Vela by saying, oh, well, the issue, I forget what page it was on, but they said, well, Vela makes the issue, that's not the issue here, because the issue here is whether Stevens was plaintiff's agent for delivery of the policy. And that case talks about whether the retail agent is the agent for the underwriters. I'm like, that's what you were saying? Was the reason why he wasn't your agent? Because you were trying to argue that he was our agent. I mean, it's kind of like a circular logic thing as to try to distinguish it. It's not distinguishable. It's exactly on point.
But doesn't Lloyd foresee that the way the normal course of business is that the agents or your agent out of Tennessee or whatever, wherever, I mean, has other agents? I mean, because obviously you all want to sell as many policies as possible, and not that one agent is not going to be, he's going to have representatives or agents around the country to act through it. So it's foreseeable that that money's going to go from one agent to the other.
Well, and then that's Amlin's Brokerage of Alabama's problem to deal with, and they were sued as well. So the plaintiff has recourse against them if that's what they wanted to argue, but that's not what they're arguing. They're trying to argue that somehow Stevens, their agent, for issuing an application to solicit insurance from other insurers and us, is not their agent when it comes time for delivering that policy. And it's like, when did the agency relationship stop? Did you tell us that? No. We still deal with the retail agent. That's who we're still dealing with. And, you know, another thing that they tried to argue is that, well, you have to prove that it was delivered all the way to the plaintiffs. No. And then in their reply brief, they say, you abandoned that argument. The defendants abandoned that argument. No, we didn't abandon that argument. Our argument was, no, it doesn't have to be delivered to be effective. There are a lot of times you may enter into a contract that you don't actually get a copy of it. That doesn't mean it's not binding. We delivered it, in fact, to your agent, and so that's imputed on you. So we're not abandoning that, you know, you don't have to necessarily deliver a contract for it to be effective, but we're also saying, even if that's the case, we delivered it.
And so their argument about lack of consideration, that is your argument in response to that would be, well, he paid for a no coverage policy.
Exactly.
So exactly. There was no need for, you know, consideration to be given because, you know, you already, you know, you contracted for no coverage.
Exactly. And had there been a modification, if it was a change to the original agreement, then there would need to be consideration. But it wasn't. That was the original agreement, and they didn't pay for it.
So you're saying that it does not matter whether or not the plaintiff got the policy. To you, that doesn't matter. It's just that you got it to your agent. That's all. At that point in time, when you got it to the AEIM, entity, whatever it is, you're done.
Well, no, that we got it to close, but that we got it to the plaintiff's agent. Then we're done.
But you have no direct contact with the plaintiff's agent.
Correct.
So
we know
your agent had to do it. Correct.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you.
No, it's okay.
No, we have evidence. We have the email exchange and evidence where Amlin's Brokerage of Alabama forwarded that endorsement to Stevens. Mazzaroli testified that they did receive it. So we know that it got to their agent, and that's where our obligation stops.
Okay, I know you're running out of time. I'll give you a little bit of extra time because I guess I'm not asking it right. So when the intermediary, the agent that you accept as your agent, when they got it, you don't believe you had it. You do have evidence that the other party got it, but you don't think you need it. Do you believe your duty ended there?
No.
Okay.
So we have a duty to make sure that our agent gets it to their agent.
And where is that? Where do you get that from? What kind of agency agreement is in place that makes you believe that?
I don't know that is a part of the agency agreement. I think that's just a part of our duties as an insurer to that we want to get it to the policyholder. And so we would want our agent to deliver that to the policyholder's agent. Yes. I mean, I think that would be what our obligation is. And we fulfilled that. And in fact, Peninsula Insurance Bureau, Brooke McCarthy, when she got the claim initially, checked to make sure. That was one of the first things she did when she realized there was a named storm exclusion on the policy, was to contact the broker and confirm with the broker that they sent that to the plaintiff's agent. And they had that.
And that is, I assume that email is in the record, that email correspondence?
Yes, and Mr. Mazzaroli testified to that as well. I don't know if we cited to those particular pages in our brief.
Okay.
think it's on pages 8 and 9, maybe 7, 8, and 9 of our brief has the citations to the record in there about that whole transaction. And then Brooke McCarthy, yeah, it's on page 7 where Brooke McCarthy checked to make sure that it was issued. And then...
And I guess they don't dispute that. They just, that's not a disputed issue.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Okay, I thank you for your time.
I think that in listening to opposing counsel, one thing that's important to understand is that for this to be included in the contract, for the named storm exclusion to be included in the contract, and this is a case that they cite as Liberty Mutual Insurance Company versus Sims. It's an unpublished opinion out of Tyler that they rely on for that it doesn't really need to be attached to the contract, because we know that this exclusion was not attached to the contract. But in Sims, which is a case that they rely on, it says, Texas law has long provided that a separate contract can be incorporated into an insurance policy by an explicit reference clearly indicating the party's intentions to include that contract as a part of the agreement. And so I'd like to take you back to, and we went over earlier, the declarations page where it lists all the forms. There's a forms inventory on the declaration page. The difference between the Sims case and this case is in the Sims case, it says, and finally, the forms inventory, which identifies the correct policy number, lists all the amended forms that apply as a part of this policy at inception. So, in the Sims case, it wasn't attached, but it was referenced in the forms inventory as being a part of the contract. In this case, there is no reference in the original contract. Even today, there was no amendment to the forms inventory that said this is a part of this contract. And so it's just not there. And they want to say, well, that's not what we intended. The parties didn't intend. I don't think they can speak for what Mr. Winlet intended, but when you have a written contract and Lloyd's is bound by that contract, by its cover holder, it doesn't matter. The issue, you only look at the contract itself.
But the contract provides that endorsements can be made in the future, does it not?
I think that's a good point, because if you look at it, it says, the policy terms can be amended or waived only by endorsement issued and made a part of the policy. Now, number one, this endorsement, like I said, the forms inventory never changed. It was never added to the declaration page to become a part of the policy. Number two, if you're going to modify a contract, so this gets into modification, and they do have the ability to modify it, and on its face, it is a modification. As Judge Longoria said earlier, it was sent like a month after they discovered it and almost 2 months after the original coverage date. And it says on here, this endorsement changes the policy. The endorsement modifies the insurance provided. So it's a change, and it's a change made to the policy well after the date of the policy's inception. So when we look at this, number one, it was never incorporated into the policy. Number two, there was no consideration given for it. And they want to say, well, the consideration never contemplated that there would not be a named storm exclusion, but you have to look at the policy, and the consideration was for the policy that was attached. And, you know, and it was put together by the insurance company. They provided the policy. It said, this pays for this policy, and we are bound by this policy. Then they want to say, oh, we didn't mean to do that. But the fact that they didn't review the own policy that they prepared is, you know, they're still bound by the policy that they agreed to. And there really is no exception that allows them to go back and say, hey, look at all this stuff that happened before. I would like to point out, like with some of this stuff that she mentioned, the application, Mr. Winlet never saw the application. Stevens made the application. A lot of the binders and stuff where they say it was in there, that's all insurance stuff, stuff that happens behind the scenes. You know, Mr. Winlet was not a part of any of that. The only thing that I think that they can show that Mr. Winlet saw was there were some proposals that were provided that said, never had the language of the named storm exclusion, never saw that before the hurricane, but it said named storm exclusion. Now, whenever I first started with this case, and I heard named storm exclusion, you know, what's that? I've been practicing law here for 20-something years, and I never heard, and wouldn't have believed in South Texas there'd be such a thing as a named storm exclusion. And so I didn't understand that. And then when you read the exclusion itself, it's very, you know, I can read it 5, 6, I don't know, way more than that times to try to get an idea of what this actually excluded. But you don't really get into that because it wasn't ever a part of the policy.
But you're, and so I know we're out of time, but I just have this follow-up question. So let's pretend hypothetically that your client had received the endorsement. If he had received it and acknowledged receiving it back in April, before anything, if he said, yes, I received this endorsement and it's not covered, would he be bound by that at that time under the terms of the policy?
And that gets to the consideration.
Yes.
The consideration paid was for the policy that was in the original contract. So I think arguably, I mean, that would clearly be a closer question.
It should be nice if y'all had a case to address this.
I think the closest case is the Supreme Court case that I was citing to you earlier. I didn't bring that up.
The Travelers case? Yeah, it's the Travelers case.
Yeah, I think it's Edwards, versus Edwards. And, you know, and it says that, no, that under the Edwards case, no, that wouldn't be enough without additional consideration. In that case, they said, well, we never give insurance to students unless we have that no other drivers can drive their car. You know, we never would have done this. And then they sent it to him and he signed it. But then they said, even though that was the intention maybe from the beginning, that doesn't matter because that's not the contract you sent. And if you're going to change the contract, there needs to be consideration. So to answer your question, I think that they still don't meet the consideration. I don't think they even get offer and acceptance because it never got to our clients for him to be able to receive an offer. He was never able to agree to it. He never read it until after the hurricane. So there could be no change unless he has a lot of authority with Stevens. Stevens has a lot of authority to do stuff without him knowing about it, making agreements without him knowing about it. But there's just no evidence that they want to say, well, there's no evidence that Stevens was our agent, but that's not, we don't have to prove that he was their agent. They have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt that he was our agent for the purpose of receiving the policy and that we are bound by anything that he receives. And there's just no evidence that we ever gave him that authority.
Thank you. Ms. Alkus, if you want another minute or
just 1 minute.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're being generous here. We're the only ones.
There's nobody here. You'll see it
afterwards. The court will indulge. Can I speak from here?
Wherever you'd like.
Okay. I was just going to say, you're correct. The part of the policy that says that you can issue endorsements that is in the court's record at page 454 to make it easy to find. I think that we distinguished that Traveler's case, the Supreme Court case about the endorsement for the student driver. That's not the situation here. That's not the situation here. And we distinguished that because here, he just added that Bill Winlet never saw the application or the binder or what have you, but it doesn't matter because his agent was doing that for him. The agent was shopping that for him. We have a right to rely on what his agent is doing for him. And so also I wanted to draw the court's attention to back to the Vela case, because in answer to Justice Hinojosa's question, that's the case that's probably the most important and most on point with the scenario that we're dealing here. This is a case where this is what the parties intended. So if you take that last thing that he was just saying about maybe there was no, maybe if the offer wasn't ever really accepted, we don't have a contract then.
And that's a very dangerous argument to make. If we have a contract, it's the contract that was in place before the storm. If that's not the contract you like, then you need to move to modify that contract or reform it to reflect what the party's intent was. And just as the last final point, the standard is just preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt.
Be under submission, guys. Do you want to add one more thing?
Yeah, one thing that I did want to, when it says in there that it can be amended by a form submitted, that's kind of like this, that doesn't mean that that's the only thing that's required to modify a contract. That's an additional requirement. You still have to modify the requirement. If I put in my contract for all my clients, no amendment to this is effective unless signed by John. That doesn't mean that if John signs it, it's effective for everyone. You still have to modify the contract. But if there's emails back and forth, that wouldn't be enough to modify the contract. You'd have to go through the process of making the agreement, and then they would have to issue the form.
Thank you. Case will be under submission. Thank you.